We are talking once again with Jav Parrish, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I always hesitate saying that because we record this actually late Saturday morning, and then the show airs multiple times over the weekend, and including Monday evening, so... Every time somebody listens to this in another time slot, they're like, what planet are these guys on? As if they wouldn't come up with that already.
or what time zone, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so starting out with local and more information coming out regarding Compassion Seattle.
Yeah, we talked about this last week. It's a proposed charter amendment that got the go-ahead to gather signatures with the aim of getting on the ballot probably early next year. And it was rolled out with much fanfare last week as being a homeless initiative that was coordinated by Tim Burgess, but that had a lot of heavy hitters on board, both from the business community and some people from the downtown homeless industrial establishment. This was heralded as a great breakthrough that the business leaders had finally seen the light and realized that you had to organize for the long term and create affordable housing in order to get homeless off the streets, et cetera, et cetera. This was seen as a great insight of the pandemic, as though homeless advocates haven't been saying this for the last 20 years. So, this week, we got the first financial disclosures of donations to Compassion Seattle, and it was very interesting, particularly because the lead donor to the campaign for the signature gathering is Vulcan Properties. You may have heard of them. $25,000 donation to the Compassion Seattle campaign. We also had the Downtown Seattle Association at $18,000. Tim Seiss, former chief of staff to Greg Nichols, at $5,000. And a whole bunch of developers that you've probably never heard of. This can be interpreted a couple different ways. First, it can be interpreted as, well, that's Tim Burgess's Rolodex. It's who he knows. So naturally, that's who he's going to turn to first. We'll see if they add to that over time. But also, you notice there are no homeless advocates or homeless service organizations on that list anywhere, even with smaller donations. So this tells me that this is primarily a business community initiative, and that the homeless advocates were pretty much added for window dressing. It's going to be very interesting to see what signature gatherers are telling the public when they're trying to get signatures. You know, what is this about? Is this about abolishing encampments in the parks or keeping our schools safe? Is it about creating affordable housing? Are they going to be telling different things to different audiences? And then we'll look at subsequent donations, and we'll look at how they pitch it to community organizations and the public if it qualifies for the ballot. But early indications are that this is an initiative by a lot of people who have gotten homelessness policies wrong over the last 20 years, and who are trying to score PR points at this point. We talked about this last week, that it's got some serious flaws as a policy initiative. It's being written into the charter of the city of Seattle, which means that it obligates the city of Seattle to spend a certain amount of money on affordable housing and various social safety net programs over, indefinitely. So, that is structurally a problem. It would be about 12% of the city's budget, and that money would have to come from somewhere, or the money would have to be raised somehow. And it really doesn't address that in the in this measure. So, it's a step in the right direction, but flawed. And I think at this point it would be wise to be very cautious of of the motives and intent of the sponsors of this proposed charter amendment.
And I see this week they submitted on Thursday an updated version of the amendment.
Yeah, they tweaked it a little bit to clarify the wording. I maybe I missed it, but I didn't see anything truly significant that they changed. But it does suggest that some of the flaws in the proposal can be fixed, you know, before they start printing petitions and gathering signatures. At which point it's more or less written in stone. But yeah, they've still got time to change it, and you know, hopefully they're hearing from homelessness advocates and homelessness service providers. Really, you know, the folks that they consulted with on that side of the equation are really all part of the downtown establishment, downtown emergency services center, public defender Lisa Daugard, you know, Plymouth Housing, you know, some of the other heavy hitters downtown. But you know, a lot of the service providers around the city were not consulted on this, and I think their response has been lukewarm so far.
When do they have to basically have it finalized? Obviously, before they start collecting signatures, but when can they start collecting signatures?
They can start collecting signatures when the city attorney gives the go-ahead, I believe. So I'm not sure what the timeline on that is. It's, you know, it's a legal review to make sure the language comports with, you know, city laws and all that. Usually that's within a couple of weeks, so I would think it pretty quickly. And then once that go-ahead happens, they have 6 months to collect a little over, I forget how many signatures, but it's a pretty substantial number. It's like 25% of the city's electorate, so that's a high hurdle. But you know, if they've got enough money, they can probably do it. The other thing that gets in the way, of course, is that, you know, we may or may not have large crowds in any one place this summer due to the pandemic. That's going to make things harder for them. You know, the usual, you know, large festivals, folk life, you know, Hemp Fest, those kind of things, may not be available this year. So, Folk Life has already been canceled, I believe. Hemp Fest is trying to decide. And, you know, Capitol Hill Block Party, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We'll see how safe it is for some of those events to take place this summer.
It'll be interesting to see if they make any further changes between now and when they start gathering signatures.
Yes.
It's always interesting to see the sausage being made. It's also interesting to me how many of these larger operations hire out-of-state firms to do, you know, a significant portion of their campaign. Compassion Seattle appears to be no different in that, where they're hiring an out-of-state firm to do the actual signature gathering. So you would
think. Yeah, and the actual signature gatherers you know, there's like this whole industry of people who just go from city to city and gather signatures is what they do. So we've had campaigns in the past where the signature gatherers all turned out to all come up from California, you know, to work for 4 or 6 weeks or whatever to gather signatures.
It's part of that.
And they don't necessarily have any idea what they're asking people for. And so, and this is particularly true for Kim Iman initiatives. Some of the come-ons to people have been highly misleading in the past.
So, issue we will be following as it, again, weaves through the machinery here.
Yeah, and it's less than a month now until the filing deadline, and then the election campaigns will get underway for the primary in August in full swing.
Okay. All right, moving on from that. The SPD officer who was in charge of the sweep, the navigation team, resigned this week.
Yes.
Or at least news of it came out this week.
Yes, Lieutenant, I hope that I'm pronouncing this correctly, Sina Ebenje. I probably butchered her name. Sorry about that, or his name. Sorry about that. That was the SPD officer who headed the navigation teams that swept homeless encampments under Mayor Durkan. Ebenje resigned this week, or as you say, maybe it was earlier, but we found out about it this week, due to an OPA investigation into abuses of authority when she was heading the navigation team. I believe it's she. This sort of underscores the problematic nature of the navigation team sweeps. People lost a lot of possessions that were either thrown away or possibly stolen. There certainly wasn't the city was avid about finding loopholes so they didn't have to give notice, which is required under the statute. But the city would declare a public health emergency and get around it for that reason. In all, the navigation teams were, they were supposed to, help people find shelter or offer shelter to people. But in practice, it was just seen as a punitive thing that would help get rid of the homeless people. And of course, you don't get rid of the homeless people except for the ones who die off. You just, move them from neighborhood to neighborhood and, push them around. And in the meantime, they're having, critical possessions like, IDs and medical records and things like that being thrown away by the city, when it swoops down on these encampments. A new mayor will have a more humane policy on homelessness and a saner policy on homelessness. I mean, we know what works. What works is permanent affordable housing. That is ostensibly what Compassion Seattle is about as well. But it has very much not been what the Durkan administration has been about.
Well, it appears that the whole reason she is retiring revolves around one of the actions she did while she was in charge, which was direct the company that picks up garbage from the encampments to go to her house over in West Seattle and pick up a bunch of garbage of hers, including large pieces of furniture.
I thought you said and deliver the.
So that particular incident where she was asking again, the cleanup crew to go to her place and pick up her garbage. And then later, upon it being reported by Erica Barnett at Publicola, it appears that she again went through, not Erica Barnett, the officer, made extensive efforts to cover up the whole thing, asking people to delete emails, electronic records of it.
Oh, that's not good.
So that's what, again, according to Erica Barnett's reporting, OPA had a problem with. So
I'll bet.
Let's move on then to developments this week regarding the pandemic.
Yeah, there is still a pandemic. Even though it's nice and sunny and warm this weekend, you still need to wear a mask outside. You still need to social distance. You still need to wash your hands when you get home. All the rest of things you've gotten familiar with over the last year. The numbers are still going up in King County and in the Puget Sound region generally, and in 38 out of the 50 states. The good news this week is that all people over the age of 16 are now eligible for vaccination. And those appointments filled up fast, depending on where you ask. There are places around town where you can actually get a vaccine. You won't be getting the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, however. That was paused this week due to blood clot complications that turned out in approximately 6 out of the 7 million people who have been vaccinated with Johnson & Johnson so far. It is a rare side effect, but it is a very serious side effect. And hopefully by the CDC pausing this and the state, as with every state, following suit very quickly, You know, if there are other cases out there, we'll find out about them. Meantime, that put a huge crimp, not just in the rollout in the United States, but globally. A lot of places were counting on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. It was paused not just in the U.S., but also in Europe, South Africa, Australia, et cetera. The vaccination rate overall in the U.S. has been going spectacularly well. The U.S. passed 200 million vaccinations yesterday. You remember, originally Joe Biden wanted to do 100 million in 100 days. Well, he got 200 million in 75 days, which is just remarkable, especially since they didn't inherit a plan from the Trump administration. So they had to do it all from scratch. That's really impressive, I gotta say. We're starting to see, the effects of all that vaccination. Approximately half of all adults in the U.S. now have had at least one shot of a COVID-19 vaccine. So that's good. At the same time, you know, we're seeing, particularly under the age of 40, which of course is the people who haven't been as vaccinated, and are the people who are likely to be out partying this weekend. Those cases have been increasing dramatically. We're seeing huge spikes in much of the eastern U.S. at this point, probably as a result of spring break in Florida. Cases in Miami-Dade County, and where you saw those COVID crowds last month, those have doubled in the past 2 weeks. So that's not a good sign. And a lot of people who went to spring break in Florida then went home afterwards to all over the country, New York, Michigan, wherever. And we're seeing those cases spike as well. Those cases have been driven a lot by different variants, particularly the British B.1.1.17 variant, which is extremely transmissible and about 60% higher mortality than the original virus. So new and improved. We're seeing more cases also of the South African variant and also to some degree the Brazilian variant. And we've had all three of those in the Seattle area. So again, now is not the time to be cavalier about the public health precautions we've learned over the last year. Globally, today we reached 3 million deaths total worldwide, which is a staggering number when you think about it. And the worst place in the world right now for the virus is not the United States, it is India. India is adding 200,000 or 300,000 new cases each day, which is a lot. Only the U.S. has exceeded that in the past. And it's going to get worse because, thanks to religion, we're getting, the mother of all super spreading events, the annual pilgrimage to Hindu faithful to the River Ganges, where I'm sure you've seen this in different, you know, specials over the years. Millions and millions of people crowd together to wash themselves in the Ganges River. And I suppose it's outdoors, so it could be worse, but that sounds like in a country that is having an extreme pandemic right now, that sounds like a disaster waiting to happen, and that is happening right now. We also entered, I'm drawing a blank on the name, Muslim Holy Weeks. Ramadan, which has, several components that involve crowds of people. And, of course, you know, pilgrimages to holy sites in Mecca and elsewhere. Those crowds also are a super spreader event waiting to happen. And we saw in Saudi Arabia and other Muslim countries some efforts to try and limit, for instance, people praying in mosques and staying overnight. you know, those kind of things, the kind of feasts that happen at the end of Ramadan. So that is also likely to drive a further spike in global cases. So, and it's a, and a lot of these places, particularly Muslim countries, poorer countries, have not had real widespread access to vaccines yet. So I think that's kind of going to drive a huge global spike in the next 2 or 3 weeks, which is unfortunate.
But India is one of the nations that is producing their own vaccine and has been distributing it both within the country as well as distributing it to other countries.
Yeah, they've actually stopped exporting the vaccine because they're and they also did an emergency authorization for any vaccine that had been approved by the United States, the European Union, WHO, Japan. I think there were a couple of other developed countries on that list. They are desperately trying to vaccinate as many people as they can, as quickly as they can, because they really do have a huge spike going on right now.
And I know internationally there is a big push at the WTO to remove the barriers, the financial and patent barriers on the different vaccines.
I believe it's WHO, not WTO.
No, I think WTO, because that's in charge of trade and monetizing things. So, you know, the pharmaceutical companies still want their patents and they want their pound of flesh in a way.
Of course they do. Yeah, and that's been a huge barrier to poorer countries getting the vaccine. The WHO has had the COVAX program, which was trying to roll out vaccines to poorer and middle-income countries. That hit a snag because much of the vaccine that the COVAX program was able to make available was Johnson & Johnson, or it was AstraZeneca, which has also had the blood clot issue. So there's huge problems both with availability, depending on the regulatory agencies in different countries, and also the public's confidence in the vaccine and their willingness to take it.
All right. Well, suspect we're going to be touching on this again next week.
Yeah, and the week after. Yep.
Let's move on to national news.
Boy, there was a lot of national news this week.
Starting with the Treasury.
Yeah, the U.S. Treasury came out with a very interesting document that was actually produced this week by the the intelligence agencies that were asked after the confirmation of the DNI to look into the whole cluster of allegations regarding Russia and the United States, Russian behavior. They were very interesting findings. First of all, the intelligence agencies were not able to verify the report that got a lot of publicity last year about a bounty being placed on U.S. military personnel in Afghanistan by Russian operatives that were willing to pay Afghan fighters if they killed American troops. U.S. intelligence could not verify that with high confidence. They did find with high confidence almost everything else. So, for instance, that Russia was, in fact, behind the huge hack last year by U.S. government and corporate entities. That was Russia's doing. They did find that Russia interfered in the election in both 2016 and 2020. The real bombshell in the document was that in 2016, then campaign chair for the Trump campaign, Paul Manafort, His Ukrainian business partner, Konstantin Kalimnik, who for years has been considered a Russian intelligence operative, that he passed on internal polling data from the Trump campaign to Kalimnik, and Kalimnik in turn, this is new, passed it on to Russian intelligence. That is your collusion right there. Because at the same time, Russian intelligence was actively trying to influence social media and doing social media pushes, particularly in swing states like Wisconsin and Michigan and Pennsylvania, all of which Trump unexpectedly won. And it wasn't just that the Trump campaign, Russia, if you're listening and sort of might be vaguely aware that Russia wanted them to win and they're happy to accept it. No, they were actively colluding with Russia to try and help Russia influence the campaign and giving them data so that they could micro-target precincts in American states that might be susceptible to the Trump pitch. This is assisting somebody who is actively attacking the United States, 21st century style. That's the definition of treason. And Donald Trump apparently is guilty of it. So that was a huge revelation that really got buried in a lot of the other news this week, but deserves to be highlighted. Russia also was trying to influence the 2020 campaign, particularly by trying to push the Hunter Biden conspiracy theory. And it's interesting that right-wing media, Fox News and One America Network and all the rest of that, were happy to do Russian propaganda in order to try and help their guy win. The fact that he didn't win doesn't change that. These are all traitors, honestly. And it really raises the question whether Donald Trump spent 4 years as president of the United States as a Russian asset, wittingly or not. And the more we learn, the more we think it might have been quite wittingly. So there was that. At the same time, yesterday, the Treasury Department announced that the Department of Justice, I'm sorry, announced that it was investigating Roger Stone for some $2 million in back taxes that he has not paid. And remember, Donald Trump pardoned him in his last days in office, but he pardoned him for his previous felony conviction. He didn't give him a blanket pardon that would cover any other legal violations. So Stone is in all kinds of hot water once again, he and his wife both, for trying to hide assets so they could avoid paying taxes on them. What can you say? It's a crime family, and Donald Trump seems to attract people who are just as criminally minded as he is. Speaking of which, we also had another interesting tidbit come up in the last day or so. A guy named Val Brooksnit is a resident of Los Angeles. He has been reported as missing. Now, the name Val Brooksnit probably isn't familiar to most of you. He is the son of the former CEO of Deutsche Bank, and he has been a whistleblower who has been cooperating with both the FBI and the House Intelligence Committee looking into investigations into Trump's finances and his ties with Deutsche Bank and Russian laundering and all the rest of that. So the fact that this guy has gone missing is really concerning. Like I said, Trump tends to operate as a crime family, and I don't think that's above dealing with a threat like that violently. So they're very worried. The investigative reporter for the New York Times, who had been using him as a source, has sounded the alarm, saying this guy has gone missing. His girlfriend hasn't seen him since April 6th. What has happened to him? His father, the former CEO of Deutsche Bank, committed suicide in 2014. So there's that in his background as well. It's a very concerning situation and one we should keep an eye on.
All right, let's move on then. President Biden announces a change in Afghan policy.
Yeah, a major change. He announced that as of September 11th, 2021, which will be the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, the U.S. will have withdrawn from Afghanistan, all military presence. That doesn't mean the U.S. is going to entirely withdraw from Afghanistan. They will still be training Afghan troops. They will still be doing special operations in the region. And so, you know, Biden is trying to reassure people that the Taliban can't set up terrorist bases, et cetera, et cetera. But the Taliban already controls two-thirds of Afghanistan. The U.S.-supported government, which is basically the air controls the area around Kabul, and that's about it. And the rest of Afghanistan, various regional warlords control. So, you know, the Afghan government really is a government in name only. It has the recognition of the United States and most Western countries, but it's been a joke for many, many years and a corrupt joke at that. And, you know, after 20 years, I think Biden correctly concluded that, you know, there's no real mission here. It's just a perpetual war for the sake of perpetual war, and it's kind of pointless. You know, bin Laden has been dead for a decade and plus. And, you know, the Taliban already control vast swaths of the country, and Afghanistan is a notorious, difficult country for any foreign invader. Just ask the Russians. Just ask the British. I mean, this goes back centuries. It's a very rugged country geographically, and a country that doesn't take well to outsiders. And, you know, the U.S. has spent 20 years and literally trillions of dollars for no apparent purpose. And, you know, over 2,000 service members in the U.S. dead, and God knows how many Afghans dead as well. So that is going to come to an end, thank goodness. You know, it doesn't mean that the U.S.'s imperial designs in the region are done, particularly since Afghanistan borders China and is very close to Russia. And those two countries appear to be the focus of Biden administration's foreign policy, particularly China. He had a meeting yesterday with the prime minister of Japan. He'll meet with the prime minister of South Korea next month. And, you know, he appears very, very concerned about China and sees China as the primary economic and foreign policy competitor to the United States over the next, you know, decades. So, you know, the adults are finally in the room in terms of U.S. foreign policy. It's interesting that this is another area where Donald Trump talked for 4 years about wanting to get out of Afghanistan. He actually cut a deal with the Taliban that didn't get a lot of attention about a year ago and was supposed to be out of Afghanistan by this year. But as with most things Trump, he didn't sweat the details. The details never got ironed out. And, you know, it just kind of went by the wayside. This seems much more solid. You know, the Secretary of State was in Brussels consulting with NATO allies about this the day that Biden made the announcement, and the day after the Secretary of State was in Kabul meeting with Afghan leaders. This is called diplomacy. This is something the United States hasn't done for, you know, at least 4 years. So it was in that sense, it was sort of a welcome return to competency. And the actual withdrawal is something that has been long, long, long overdue. So we will hope that it comes to fruition as planned.
Well, yeah, it's another, you know, sounds good, but the proof is in the pudding.
Devil is in the details, yep.
And seeing how the U.S. and the powers that be can play everybody in this country so easily. Again, going back to the whole bounty story related to Afghanistan that now they're backtracking on. I mean, there's plenty of people that knew the second that story came out that it was bogus. And it just got repeated from the New York Times article about it, got picked up by a bunch of the other news outlets that didn't like look any further into it, just happened to like come out a week before a major vote on support for Afghanistan. You know, this regularly is we're regularly getting played on all this stuff, and corporate media and those that follow its lead are, you know, helping out on that. And it's,
sure.
Again, I'll believe it when I see it, but right now it just seems to be a big PR campaign. And where's the mention of the fact that Afghanistan did not attack the U.S. back in 2001? We've been, like, pounding them further into rubble for 20 years.
Oh, no, I thought it was a bad idea, and we talked about it at the time, that it was a bad idea when the invasion happened. And I was very alone on that because people were angry about 9/11 and wanted to attack somebody, anybody. It didn't matter if they had anything to do with it. And, of course, the Afghan government, it was a very indirect link at best. Didn't matter. So we backed the Northern Alliance, which is a ragtag group of mercenaries that the CIA managed to help overthrow the Afghan government and plunge the country into another 20 years of chaos.
No, I know we were talking about that at the time. I'm just saying now, in retrospect, you're not getting a big headline that says, boy, 20 years of us inciting this crime on Afghanistan, you know, there will never be an apology about this.
Of course not, no. And I don't think any of the military contractors are going to give their money back.
Well, a bunch of them are still going to be employed there, is my understanding of the reading of it. So,
yeah. You know. So we'll see how that works out.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the people of Afghanistan are going to see up close and personal how that works out. But
yes.
All right. Well, speaking of us shipping guns everywhere in the world and set.
Yeah, we apparently have an infinite supply of those guns, at least domestically. There was a, you know, an epidemic of gun violence this week in the headlines, the most prominent of which was yet another mass shooting, this one in Indianapolis on Thursday night. Former employee of a FedEx facility, 19 years old, white guy, and I only mention that because most of the shooters seem to be white guys these days, and young, shot and killed 8 people before killing himself. It's not clear yet what his motive is. Police certainly aren't saying, but, you know, yet another community, added to the geography of mass shooting events in the United States. And that event came 14 years to the day after Virginia Tech, which up until Las Vegas was the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history. I think it was 38 or something like that. People died on the Virginia Tech campus in 2008. And that seems like a lifetime ago. And in terms of mass shootings, it is. Because these have just become more and more frequent as the kind of high-capacity weapons of war in civilian hands that can be owned by 19-year-olds with mental health issues. That's become more and more common. And the other headline from Thursday that kind of got crowded out of the news by Indianapolis was a gunman showed up at the San Antonio International Airport and started shooting randomly. He wound up not killing anybody. He was killed himself by police. But that was another scary incident that didn't get as much attention because everything else that was going on Thursday. It's been a very busy news week. Meantime, we have the law enforcement killings, and these seem to be the primary purveyor of gun violence in the United States these days. Of course, the one that has dominated the headlines all this week has been the killing of 20-year-old Dante Wright in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, northern suburb of Minneapolis. He was pulled over for what should have been a routine traffic stop. And then Officer Kim Potter, there was a struggle of some sort when he was trying to get back in the car. And she says she reached for her taser, and the body cam footage shows that she reached for her gun instead and shot him. There is a lot of skepticism. The 26-year veteran of the police department, who is literally one of the trainers of other police and the president of that police union could accidentally fire a gun instead of a taser. There's the differences between like 13 ounces and 30 ounces. The taser should have had warning tape, yellow tape to differentiate it from the black Glock. But that's what she says. And she has been indicted for manslaughter, second degree. A lot of activists thought that it should have been more than that. Meantime, we got a couple of other major releases of body cam footage this week. In Chicago, the killing on March 29th of 13-year-old Adam Toledo. He was running away from police. Apparently, we don't necessarily know this with a gun. And he reached a fence, dropped the gun, turned around, raised his hands, and then in that second while that was happening, the officer shot and killed him. The body cam footage of that has outraged a lot of people, not just in Chicago, but nationally. We saw I'll get to the major demonstrations in a minute. There was also another body cam footage release that didn't get nearly as much attention this week in Los Angeles, the March 13th killing of a guy named Samuel Ponce, who apparently was having mental health issues and acting out, banging on hoods of cars, that kind of thing. And police were tailing him, and he turned around and threw a hammer at one of them, and they shot him. This has not gotten as much attention nationally. I'm not sure why. Maybe it's a little older. He was Latino, Mexican, rather than black. But it shouldn't have made a difference. I'm not sure of Toledo's ethnicity, but he lived in Little Village, which is the largest Mexican community within Chicago. So, that was happening in L.A. as well. And then yesterday we had a police killing in Portland, in Lenz Park in southeast Portland, of a homeless guy who reportedly, and this has not been confirmed yet, so put an asterisk by it, had a toy gun, shades of Tamir Rice. And he was shot and killed by police. So there were major demonstrations last night in Portland, in Oakland, in Los Angeles, in Chicago, in New York, in D.C., there was a demonstration here in Seattle. And of course, there have been demonstrations every night this week, six nights in a row in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota, as well as in Minneapolis. The Brooklyn Center police response has been, increasingly militarized, increasingly aggressive. About 100 people were arrested last night. The police literally attacked people as they arrived before they had a chance to declare an illegal assembly. At the time they arrived, there was no curfew imposed, unlike earlier in the week. An emergency curfew was then declared for 11 o'clock. But, the police were attacking protesters with, quote-unquote, less than lethal munitions. Some of the gas and munitions were also going into nearby apartment buildings. I have seen on some of the live streams this week where people were launching fireworks from those apartment buildings. Residents at this point are pretty hostile to the police as well. To be clear, these are demonstrations outside the Brooklyn Center police station, the headquarters there. It's a suburb of about 30,000, about the size, say, of Woodinville. It's not that large. It is plurality black population. Their mayor is their first black mayor. He's taken over the police department because both the head of police and Potter resigned early in the week. It was a very, very bad police killing that went viral very quickly because the body cam footage was released on Monday. It was Sunday afternoon killing. And this all happens in the context that the Derek Chauvin trial wrapped up in Minneapolis, obviously the same metropolitan area, about 10 miles away from Brooklyn Center. The defense called their witnesses on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, who did not do very much to raise any doubts about the 2 weeks of witnesses that the prosecution had trotted out. But they have rested their case. They've wrapped up their witnesses. They will rest their case, and then prosecution will rest its case on Monday. Probably on Monday, the judge will give the jury instructions, and the jury will start deliberating. So we're likely to have some sort of a verdict in the Derek Chauvin trial sometime next week. And the entire Twin Cities metropolitan area is on edge about that. I saw one person describe the Twin Cities as being under military occupation right now. I don't think that's a exaggeration. There's a lot of National Guard, both in Brooklyn Center and in Minneapolis. There was scattered looting in Minneapolis as well this week. As well as a lot of looting the first couple nights in Brooklyn Center. It's been peaceful since then. But I also saw an interview with one of the more prominent Twin Cities organizers who had, you know, was a sort of a leading figure in the George Floyd protests last year. And he was saying basically, you know, if you've got anything to lose, stay away, go home. You know, we need people who have nothing to lose. And that is the scariest thing I've ever heard from a protest organizer, not just in the past year, but in like, you know, 30 years of activism. I think it's probably realistic, but I think it also means that, next week could be gnarly. And I'm expecting tonight, Saturday night, as we air this on Saturday, to have some major protests. There were thousands of people protesting in Chicago last night, for example, over the death of Adam Toledo. I mean, you need a scorecard to keep track of all these right now. It's a very, very discouraging.
Yeah, not to minimize their situation there, but more and more we just see larger segments of the country that have nothing to lose.
Yeah.
That our system is inflicting upon them. So,
yeah.
All right.
And you know, people, I mean, law enforcement in this country is seriously broken. It's becoming more and more clear it's not a training issue. It's not something that can be reformed. You need to defund the police. You need to find a different model, a completely different model of ensuring public safety. Because the policing in the United States, you know, has its roots in a 19th century industrialism and trying to keep people in check. And it really has not, evolved beyond that. And as long as you have the cultural rot within departments like SPD, you know, you can have all the reforms in the world and it's not going to get you anywhere.
It occurred to me that'd be a great band name, Cultural Rot.
Yeah, it might well be.
All right. I see you have here talking about some rollbacks.
Yeah, there were a couple of important rollbacks of Trump administration policies that came out this week. The first thing I want to talk about, and neither of these got very much attention, but they should. The first is new Attorney General Merrick Garland announcing that the Justice Department would be in the business once again of negotiating consent decrees with different cities and different troubled city police departments. Now, this is the sort of agreement that the Seattle Police Department has been under for nearly a decade, stemming from the Obama administration and DOJ investigation in, I believe, 2013 that found that SPD had systemic problems with, you know, use of force policies. They didn't find racial bias within SPD, but the only reason they didn't find it was because SPD hadn't been keeping those statistics. So ever since then, how SPD operates has been, and things like union contract approvals have been subject to the approval of a federal judge. Those consent decrees are in a number of cities around the country. but they all stem from the Obama administration. None of them at all were pursued under Trump, because the Trump people basically gutted the budget for doing the investigations that could lead to a dissent decree. That has now been restored under Merrick Garland, and they will once again be in the business of populating their civil rights division and looking at civil rights abuses by police departments in different parts of the country. Like I said, I'm not sure that the institution is reformable at this point, but it is good to have that investigatory arm looking at police departments and trying to hold them accountable, because lack of accountability has been a serious problem for the past 4 years under Trump. Police departments knew they could get away with anything, that there would be no federal intervention. And that has been a real problem in terms of bad behavior by police, certainly as we saw last year and as we're starting to see again this year. Heavy-handed police responses, even last night in all those different cities that I mentioned, Chicago and Brooklyn Center particularly. But, you know, also Portland, also New York City, also D.C., also Chicago. You know, police departments have gotten in the mindset, if they were ever out of it, of thinking they can get away with anything. And that is a real problem. That cannot stand. They see protesters as something inherently illegal, something inherently oppositional to their you know, to their very existence, really, to their jobs, and that's probably accurate. But you know, people have a right to protest, and as long as it's peaceful, you know, it's you know, and even minor things like property destruction or throwing water bottles or whatever, that does not merit you know, huge military responses against the entire group. You know, that is something that we saw a lot last summer with SPD here, and I expect we'll see more of it this summer. You know, we certainly saw it in the war zone that was downtown Portland, and we're seeing it now in Brooklyn Center also, where the response is just over the top compared to the size of the crowd and what they're doing or not doing. Hopefully, the Department of Justice will get back in the business of investigating these police departments, because that kind of scrutiny is very welcome. And it's a slow process, but it is a valuable process. So that was one rollback. The other rollback was newly confirmed Interior Secretary Deb Haaland, the first Native American cabinet secretary in U.S. history, and she is already making waves. She rolled back a series of Trump-era policies in Interior yesterday, including the promotion of fossil fuel development on public lands and waters. And Haaland also issued a separate directive that prioritizes dealing with climate change in Interior Department policy. Now, that can mean all kinds of things. It can mean fuel-efficient vehicles. It can mean setting up windmills and solar panels on public lands. You know, all kinds of different ways that the vast holdings of public land in the United States that's owned by the federal government or managed by the federal government can be modified to make it you know, more climate change friendly. That was a huge step environmentally, and something that again got almost no attention yesterday. But very, very good news. Elections have consequences, as the conservatives like to say 4 years ago. You know, karma's a bitch. So here we are. We're seeing a lot of new policies being rolled out. It's going to take any number of months and probably years to try and repair the damage that was done during Trump's 4 years of being Russia's 53rd oblast. you know, their client state. You know, it progress is slow, but it is being made.
With that, I think we're pretty much out of time.
That's what happens.
All right, so we will talk to you again this same time next week.
I'm looking forward to it, and I'm sure there will be lots to talk about.